Okay, welcome everybody. Thank you for coming. You know, I know it was a little short notice for some people, but I'm glad you came. You know, that's thanks over to Abdi because, you know, we all know, you know, that he's a great speaker also because, you know, what he talks about, he cares. So, you know, we can all relate to that. So today we're going to be talking about social movements. And before we start, I'm going to invite you to an event that we're having on December 2nd. We're going to be showing the Sugar Babies film, and this is sponsored by Alpha Kappa Delta, which is the honor society at FIU, the sociology, but also by Miami Autonomy and Solidarity. So I'm gonna pass out this really quick to the people that haven't gotten it yet. Okay, now it's all part.
Okay, so good evening, everybody. First of all, in the name of MASC, we would like to thank everybody for coming here tonight, and also Kappa Alpha Kappa Delta Sociology Honor Society at FIU for helping us to make this activity possible. And we want to thank Professor Abdi too. Miami Autonomy and Solidarity is it's an organization of people who have come together with the purpose of developing a revolutionary organization that works within the social movements that already exist here in Miami, and also at a revolutionary level, with the ultimate goal of contributing to develop an autonomous popular class movement. Our intention is to open new spaces down here for discussion, for participation, and taking into consideration what the world saw during Iran's last presidential elections. We think it's important to have a debate, a discussion on the state of those social movements that are fighting for change in Iran, and that seems to have captured everybody's attention. So I'd like to introduce Professor Abdi.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. I've been talking to Daniel, and I really felt that it's important because I've spoken about the movement when it was happening as opposed to right now. It's really fizzled out a little bit, mainly not because people don't like to be in the streets, but because they've arrested many of the leaders and even the non-leaders. So you don't see as much activity in the streets compared to 3-4 months ago. And I think it's really important not just for the people to hear about this movement from the mass media perspective, but also from a perspective that doesn't necessarily represent the mass media, and that's a little bit more analytical, just to say the least, and possibly a little more to the left, which is usually more analytical, if I may say. You may not agree with that, but the left has to be more analytical because it's constantly isolated and has to defend itself all the time. So when you have to defend yourself all the time, you become, by nature, analytical or second nature. So this is a really good gathering, and I'm happy that people are voluntarily interested in hearing about the mass movement. I don't really want to make this out into a lecture. I just want to talk about some general ideas, possibly a little bit of theory to back that up, and then I'm hoping to get some kind of a discussion going, because for me to talk only with no discussion is quite boring. And so tell me in about, I guess, 10-15 minutes, I have a watch, I can do that, 10-15 minutes, and we'll, if you don't mind, we'll start discussing the movement, and maybe if you think I have some inside information, I would be glad to tell you, but I have to be specific with your question. What I want to do is give an overview of what happened in Iran, and most of you know the general information. I'll just review it again briefly. After the June 12th election, people felt that their votes had not been counted, and so they came out in the street. I should tell you this, that about 3 weeks before the election, which was late May, I was invited to speak about the upcoming election, a fact that happens here at FIU. And since they thought that this is my area of expertise, which is really in Middle East and specifically Iran, religion and theology and theory and political thought. They wanted me to predict what's going to happen in the election, and predicting the election that occurred on June 12 wasn't really hard, because if you know about the monopoly of power in Iran, you would also know who's going to take over. And as you know, which is something that I've been trying to talk to Iranians about, and it's really hard to get across because they're really passionate about voting. I've always argued, how is it that under dictatorial setting, an election is possible? Because as soon as you have a despot or a despotic government, then it doesn't really make sense to vote. Because, I don't know if you know this, but usually during the elections in Iran, there are about more, last time it was 1,080 candidates, and it was filtered into about 8. And those 8 are decided by a body of politics, specifically 12 clerics. And so just the fact that they're able to filter people and sort of designate the ones that could be potentially presidential candidates in itself disputes or negates democracy. So when I was asking questions like this from Iranians in Iran, why do you go out and vote despite knowing that this is a dictatorial government, people would usually say, and I think it was a good answer, I'm not convinced, but it's a good answer. They would say that people don't want to shed blood anymore. They would rather do this thing through voting, which makes sense, right? Why the conflict? Why the violence? Let's just vote this guy out of office, or this government out of office. This is a more peaceful way of doing it. And you know, it doesn't get any results, because you get a cleric after another cleric, a despot after another despot, and it's not going to be a long-term solution. And so this is the kind of a setting that we're having to deal with in Iran. And what happens right now is that the movement that sort of spontaneously grew was merely the result of people's votes not being counted. And this is why people came out in the street. There was potential for it before, however, it wasn't a mass movement like this that happened in June. I want to go back and sort of tell you what had happened in the last 30 years, and the reasons why there have not been any movements as such in Iran for the past 30 years, because that's an important thing to understand. And it has to do with some theory that has to do with revolution. That is, why does revolution occur? What is the reason behind the revolution? And the revolutions that I'm talking about are revolutions like Nicaragua's, like Iran in 1979, the Russian Revolution, Chinese Revolution, Cuban Revolution, these types of revolutions that I'm talking about, socio-political revolutions. And I would also qualify revolution by saying that revolutions question the authority of the government. That is, revolutions automatically want to overthrow the state, which is the minimum for any serious revolution. And you'll see that for the past 30 years, not only in Iran, but around the world, there have not been any revolutions as such. I mean, the best thing we saw, or the closest thing we saw, was in the late 80s, and this was Eastern Europe, but I don't really count that as revolution, even with Romania, which was supposed to be the most radical, which Ceausescu. And why is that? And this is my theory. You don't have to believe me when I tell you this. You can read upon it, and you can read upon different theories on revolution. The best thing that some social scientists have been able to theorize, and I'm only telling you this theory because I am quite convinced that the bourgeoisie, that is, the ruling powers in the world, are paying close attention to the reasons why revolution occurred, so therefore they can do something about it beforehand. Ironically, this theory comes out of the left, and I mean mostly academics. And the theory is called state-centered theory. And this is a basic argument. Without getting into too much detail, revolutions occur depending on how the state suppresses the movement. That is, if the state does not suppress the movement, therefore does not radicalize the movement, and steps back in its repression and suppression, then revolutions usually don't occur. It's the simplistic way of saying it, and also it's, if you want to be superficial, you could also say it's anti-Marxian, because Marx argues, you know, from the bottom, and then top cannot correspond with the bottom, means of production, superstructure, and there's friction, and then there's revolution. That's certainly something that's always, you know, within the fundamentals of any society. However, the reasons why, or the reason why revolution occurs or doesn't occur, has to do with the suppression of the state. And let me give you examples. In Iran specifically, there have been many movements for the past 30 years, sometimes armed movements, sometimes spontaneous movements, workers' movements, students' movements, and so on. And you'll see that despite these movements, and despite the dictatorial setting that takes place in Iran, nothing serious has actually occurred. And if you go review how the state has dealt with those movements, you'll see that every time when there was perception of a movement getting radicalized, the state stepped back. And just that one step back stopped the movement to become radicalized. And you'll see that one of the reasons why this recent movement was radicalized is because the state didn't step back. All right? Let me give you another example that would make you understand. Now you'll say, similar things happened during the Shah. I don't know if you're familiar with the history a little bit, but in 1979 when the Shah was overthrown, the Shah, 2 weeks before he left Iran, this was January 16th of 1979, early January, he came on the radio and he said, and I'm quoting him, he said, "I am apologizing to every single Iranian, from a 7-month-old baby to a 7-year-old man, because I did not know what I was doing." This is right when he was being forced out. And people didn't listen. They didn't care. They wanted him out. So, you see, he tried to step back, but it was already 5 months too late. And that's why the revolution happened in Iran. Now, fast forward to this recent movement. Part of the, and certainly there hasn't been a revolution, but I want to qualify that and tell you how serious it had become, or it's become. When the movement, when the recent movement happened, I don't know if you remember, but the head cleric, Khamenei, went on the radio and said, "Forget about us counting the votes again. We're not going to do that. What we said stays. There's not going to be any change, so deal with it." Right? This is not a step back. That's exactly what radicalized the movement. Right? Not to the extent of a revolution, but it radicalized the movement. And people now said that it's the next day went in the street and said, "Well, down with the Islamic Republic," which was not their request to begin with. It wasn't one of their demands. They just wanted their vote. But the next day they say, "Down with the Islamic Republic," and "Down with the Supreme Leader." Those are giant leaps for a movement that has not even questioned the authority of the state. That is, it never became revolutionary. And as soon as you say, like I said in the beginning, as soon as you say "down with government and state authority," you're thinking revolutionary, because now you're questioning the authority of the state. And this is exactly what happened, and it only happened because the Supreme Leader came out and said, "Forget about stepping back, this is the thing, this is the way it is," and sent his forces of suppression into the streets, and they killed people, they arrested people, they beat people up, and dealt with people in that manner, instead of, I guess, political negotiation and stepping back. So here we are, faced with a spontaneous movement that's been somewhat radicalized, but what has defeated this movement is the fact that it's leaderless. All right. Now, let me also qualify this. It is often argued that if people are poor enough and repressed enough, they will rise. That's not true. That usually doesn't happen. Because repressed and poor people can't even think of alternatives. They're actually hopeless in most cases. And that's why you can see that in many cases of the world, those who are repressed and those who are poor continue to be repressed and poor without really coming up with any serious movement. And this is true not only with Iran, it's true with India, it's true with China, it's true with, you know, anywhere you want to go. When Haiti, like a good example. Now, when do people rise and question authority, given that they're repressed and poor? It's when there is a political alternative. When there is no political alternative, people won't rise. It's just as simple as that. The reason why this movement has not become as serious as it should be, given the repression of the government, is because it's leaderless. People don't really have a revolutionary, even a reformist alternative, right? And the people and the leaders that have taken over this so-called green movement are those who are directing it towards actually more conservatism, that is to the right, that is not to the left, not questioning authority of the state, not questioning supreme leaders, not questioning the fundamentals of the economy, not questioning the fundamentals of the political system. Rather, how do we get along? And that question is no longer even, I'm talking about the leadership of the same movement, who are the same clerics that used to work in the government for a long time. In fact, many of them were, some of them were torturers in prison. Some of them were people who were responsible for executing some political prisoners. They're cruel, just as cruel as the ones that are in power right now. They have taken over the leadership and are not even seriously questioning the authority of the government anymore. And unfortunately, because there is no serious leadership for the masses of people who are ready to take over state authority and state power, they've been misdirected towards another realm, which is more about negotiation. Let's see what we can do and what we can achieve through talks. And here's another thing. The Green Movement's leadership, which is mostly part of the government, they were either in the government before or are in the government now, is using the masses of people and their movement to their advantage to negotiate with the other sector of the government. And it's all about political power, and it's all about who gets the share of the economy. And now let me go into some more detail about this. The Revolutionary Guards, which is capital R, capital T, which is an entity that started as a merely military body during the Iran-Iraq War from 1980 to 1988. In order to understand how this becomes a legitimate force, you have to read some of Jeff Goodman's ideas on state and racketeering and state and war. I may be able to get into that tonight, but I don't think we have time for this. What happens is these people have taken over the leadership and are now negotiating with the other sector over what kind of economic power they can have vis-a-vis the Revolutionary Guard. The Revolutionary Guard became a main force, a military force, that's able now to take over the economy. If you go look at their presence within the economic structure of Iran, you'll see that they own a whole lot. That is, they own a lot of property. They are into production. Anybody that's in production, small or large, they take over. They actually push you aside. They take over because any realm where there is money being made, the Revolutionary Guard takes over. And they are so powerful to the extent where almost most of southern Iraq is being built by the Revolutionary Guard, right? All of the roads are being paved by the Revolutionary Guard in their capital. Most of the stores, actually, in the southern regions where the Shia are in Iraq, are being led by the Revolutionary Guard. They're building an airport with their capital. I mean, all of southern Iraq is now functioning, economically speaking and politically speaking, through the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, which is something that we may want to get into, that is, How does that happen given U.S. presence, especially military presence, in Iran? How is it that this perceived enemy of the U.S., that is Iran, has so much power in a country where the U.S. is trying to, you know, democratize and modernize? I mean, that in itself is a conflict which needs to be talked about. And then I think if we talk about that, we'll be able to sort of go over the fact that these two forces, that is Iran and the U.S., are actually enemies. And it's not true. They've never been real enemies. Rhetorically speaking, sure. Rhetorically speaking, Iran and Israel too have been enemies, but you know, not in real terms. But again, we can get into that. So here we are with the Revolutionary Guards taking over and taking over the economy. And those who have lost power in the economy and in politics are using the people's movement to their advantage to say, if you don't allow us to share power, we will unleash the masses again. Because they can. They can go out in the streets and go into Friday prayers and talk about how despotic this government is and how we should come into the streets and take over and, you know, cause trouble. And if you look at their negotiations, it's actually moving forward. That is, they're getting to some place. And I'm talking about the different sectors of the state. Whereas the people have been abandoned. They're not really getting anything, despite their force and despite their spontaneous movement. The other big thing about this is, and when I'm talking about leaderless movement, all of the serious, and I'm merely talking about maybe theoretically serious, not practically serious, because there are no leftist organizations or democratic organizations or of any kind in Iran. Everybody is abroad. They're either in the U.S. or they're in Europe. And if you look at Iranian opposition, there's probably thousands. And they're constantly at it with each other. They're more at it with each other than they are against their main enemy, which is the Islamic Republic. Which is, you know, detrimental to their own existence. I mean, that questions their own existence, because your existence, when you're an opposition force, becomes manifest through your fight against the enemy. Now, these guys aren't fighting the enemy. Their opposition is being manifest in among themselves. So the leftists are fighting amongst each other rather than the Islamic Republic. So they're not able to function, and they're not able to organize anything. When I go to these radical students, I've interviewed them a few times when I was over there, and I asked them, and I'm talking about the real radical students that are now almost all of the people that I know are in prison now. And I asked them, how do you organize yourself? You know, is there a force outside of Iran where, you know, you listen to and you take guidelines from? Invariably they say no. Because they can't really organize it. Because they're abroad. And even when you're abroad and you're trying to organize people within the country, people are skeptical. What do you know? And when I talk to these students, they call themselves the new Marxists, but not N-E-O, but new. New Marxists in Iran, they call the old Marxists traditional. They say, they're Marxists who are really Muslim. They're not really true Marxists. And and they say to me, this is one of them, I'm quoting it, just like Rosa Luxemburg. He said that I want to be able to dance in my revolution. And these traditional Marxists are just too serious. Because all they want to talk about is martyrdom. And martyrdom, if you know anything about it, is particularly religious, and it's more specifically Islamic. Because Islam, especially Shia Islam, really promotes martyrdom. And if you read Marxist material from the so-called traditionalists, you see that the first thing they talk about all the time is martyrdom. We need to give our life for the cause. Which is not really like any Marxist. Marxists don't talk like it. They you know, not, sure, we'll participate, we'll do everything, but giving our life, that's too much like Jesus. It's too much like the leaders of Shia Islam who gave their life. So they're not able to organize anything. This movement remains leaderless. And I hope I'm not giving you bad news, because it, from the looks of things, it really looked good. And people wanted to have some hope for the overthrow of the government, the Islamic Republic. So it remains leaderless. The only leaders are those that are already in the government, and they're trying to manipulate this and control it and call it the Green Movement. And nothing serious has really come from that. I'm going to end here because I know we may be losing some of you. So we can start some kind of a discussion. You can ask me questions that you think, just because I was there, I know about. Well, that's not, I research Iran and I write about that too, so you can, I guess, ask questions or even dispute what I said about whether it was revolutionary theory or, you know, what have you. Good?
All right, Professor Abdi, if you don't mind, then, to keep the conversation fluid and inclusive, I would like to volunteer to facilitate
sure.
for a little bit, so that you can also take time to respond.
Sure, okay.
So if people don't have a problem with that, go ahead and do that. I guess, any questions?
Yeah, I mean, you brought it up, but I mean, so we can talk about it, because you mentioned that, you know, in Iraq, how does the Revolutionary Guard have so much power inside of Iraq?
Mm-hmm.
You know, even the United States exists, I just wanted to know more about that.
Right. The biggest economic partner with Iraq is Iran, and it's not the U.S. economic partner, I mean trade. And in the southern regions of Iraq, when you go look at this in Najaf and Karbala, which is next basically Shia, you see that even the police force and the way that they've organized the police force to keep control of these cities has been trained by the Revolutionary Guards of Iran. They conduct, I'm familiar with the way they conduct suppression in Iran. But if you also go look at these southern regions, you see that this is the way they're repressing people, just the same way. And this is in political terms, but economically, again, Iran was the first country to invest in Iraq, and it's their biggest trade partner. And they're making a lot of money with imports and exports in Iran, and somewhat even building some infrastructure. They're abandoning infrastructure in Iran, but they're building infrastructure in Iraq because there's some money. You know, because they're making money and there is some money. So they're heavily involved in the economy of Iraq, number one. And number two, majority seats in Iraq in their parliament is Shia. So they, you know, they have that kind of political power too. Did I answer your question?
Mm-hmm. But what about the U.S.? Like, why do you think, like you said, like, it seems like they're enemies, but like, why?
The both wars of Iraq and Afghanistan, I don't mean to say this to be just as a consequence, but I don't know, maybe even intentional, worked out for the Iranian government, because it took out the two perceived instability causing governments in the region, which was the Taliban and Saddam. These people were causing instability in that region, and Iran really wanted neither one of them. So they wouldn't oppose an invasion of Iraq, and they wouldn't oppose an invasion of Afghanistan, I think. So therefore, politically speaking, it worked out for Iran. But also, U.S. doesn't really mind, because, I don't know if you know this, but they got a lot of help from the Iranian government to stabilize the politics of Iraq, just as they did to stabilize the politics of Afghanistan. In fact, I'll tell you this, the day that the Iranian mediator negotiated peace between the U.S. and the Northern Alliance, right, the new government in Afghanistan. The next day, Bush went on TV, and you remember this, and called Iran, South North Korea, and Iraq the acts of evil. You see the conflict? Today, they negotiated for peace in Afghanistan and helped out the U.S. to sort of control things over there. The next day, Bush goes on TV and says that Iran and North Korea and Iraq are the actors of evil. So look at the conflict between what actually happens at the bottom and what's said on top.
Isn't that what's called newspeak or something like that? You know, what's, I think, said is what, you know, the administration actually says. It's really the opposite, like, you know, on
It's called Newspeak, but it's nothing. It's no, nothing no, new. It's, it's a policy. It's a policy to further political agenda. I think.
I think you stated that state suppression caused revolution. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
At the time where there is a movement, not just by itself.
Okay, at the time. You don't see the economic crisis also create the state to repress the movement.
Sure, economic crisis does that, but I'll tell you this, the entire third world is constantly in an economic crisis. Then, just by that variable, you should be able to show that the third world should always be up in arms, and they're not.
I mean, the third world is constantly in the economic crisis. Yeah.
I mean, there is no third world country, and I'm being general, but mm-hmm. most third world countries, that's the nature of the economy of the third world. It's mm-hmm. constantly in crisis because of not just production, but also because of banking systems, because of you know the way people have to work, the way the entire economic structure is set up, it's always in constant crisis. You can go when I say crisis, let me put it in financial ways. Maybe you can picture it. In most of the third world, for example, there is great currency devaluation all the time. There's great financial destabilization all the time. For example, homes, you know how when it was 12% increase here every year, increase of cost for homes, we said, what the hell is going on? 12%, it should be 3% or 4%. Now, if you look at homes in the third world countries, you'll see anywhere from 80 to 200% increase in cost. That's a crisis. That's not normal for any economy. And that's what I'm talking about. And of course, it's crisis mainly because the third world serves as sort of the productive and financial backyard of the first world. So we are able to reduce our economic crisis through the third world. Who gets the crisis? The third world does. Again, I'm being, so don't tell me, well, what about Taiwan? They're not, you know, sure, there are some countries that aren't necessarily going through crises, but most of the time they are.
So you say it's a combination of leadership
alternatives
with the crisis that will create revolution in the world?
Right. That's true. Let me give you an example. From 1976 until 1983, there was a military junta in Argentina, right? I think the reason why there was a military junta in Argentina with dictatorial power was because they wanted to get people to go back to work. Start producing because that's what we need to do, right, basically. Argentina, however, ended that dictatorship with some social movement in 1983. Not just because there was economic pressure, but because there was a political alternative. Right. But if you don't have that, the junta would just
move
on.
You would channel that movement towards like a conservative movement.
Right.
Conservative movement. I have a question. Since you've been in Iran,
just one out of 10, so we'll come back to you. Do you have another question?
Well, I'm going to look at this from another point of view. I think revolution happened because of classes, of the antagonism between classes and the role of classes with Blake. I think also in the antagonism between the different conception, for example, in the United States now, we are in a revolutionary situation because not because of the contradiction between the masses and the bourgeoisie class in the United States, because within the bourgeoisie itself, there are contradictions where how the economy should be, how we should proceed with the economy. So that created a contradiction. So now that could be led by a fraction within the bourgeoisie, or it could be led by a fraction of the masses. Now, what happened in Iran, and the same thing what happened in Nicaragua, or Haiti for that matter, is the fact that the classes that led, although I don't know Iran, but I will tend to disagree, the fact that the movement was not leadership, leaderless. I think the movement had some level of leadership, but it came from the petty bourgeoisie. So basically what you get, the results you get into those movements, and because it is being led by the petty bourgeoisie, you will get a reformist result. For example, in Nicaragua, where you had a revolutionary sector of the petty bourgeoisie leading the movement. So you had a revolution, but a revolution for reform. I think that's a lesson we need to learn, that in Iran, not only unless the movement is clearly anti-capitalist and is being led by the only class that could basically overthrow capitalism, so the result will always be a reformist result. In fact, I'm from Haiti, the similarity between Haiti and Iran are so. The Red Guard, we had the Makut, which basically had political and economical power. And the movement, the 1986 movement that actually led to the overthrow of Duvalier, was a contradiction within the dominant classes itself. Because for the capitalists to evolve the way it is now in Haiti, it had to free itself. The same thing that happened in Russia, yeah. Where Glasnost, where you had a super centralized form of capitalism that was actually controlled by the state. And then for competition to exist, for capitalists to evolve, to you have production, so it needed to free itself. So you had two different worlds, Haiti and Russia, and you have in Haiti liberalization, and in Russia you had glasnost. Basically was the same front. The section of that bourgeoisie led the movement to free the society outside of, and the same thing will happen to Cuba. You know, I would guarantee, because of the development of Cuba now, you will have a section of the bourgeoisie which will basically go against state capitalism, and if the working class movement or the popular movement, the autonomous popular movement is not being built, is not being organized. So the danger for the bourgeoisie or a sector or a fraction of the bourgeoisie to take control of that movement is there. I think that will be maybe one of the difference I may have with you on this. And the other thing is the question of the, I usually talk.
We've had this difference for decades.
Yeah, I know. I know. And the question of the second and third world. For me, Haiti is a dominant country. It's not by a question of faith that Haiti is so poor. It's because of imperialism, it's because of failure of capitalism.
Right, I use
that whole Mao shit.
Yeah, that's right. I use third world in probably meaning the, you know, in world systems theory, terminology, the periphery, you know, those that are dominant.
Yeah, I'd rather use the concept of domination.
I think I disagree with your one statement you made about the condition for revolution in the U.S. already. Any kind of disagree with that?
Oh, I mean, if I want to clarify myself, I said there is a contradiction. There is a situation in the United States that exists within the bourgeoisie itself, where the possibility for the bourgeoisie to take control, whether it's a fascist sector of the bourgeoisie or the populist sector that is being led by Obama now,
mm-hmm.
It's the possibility for one of them to take the leadership of that struggle is far greater than the popular movement to stop it, because we are not organized. There is no popular movement able to give some level of resistance to any of those sectors.
Please resist. What do you mean?
If you want to answer very quickly, then we'll go to Christine. Who's got a question or a comment?
Meaning, we are to offer our own alternative to that struggle. We have to start learning how to fight based on our own interests. For example, I don't want to go elect Obama and not knowing what the hell is going to do for me. If you're a student and Obama is giving a stimulus plan, and you vote for him, what the hell you get out of it? That's what I call the autonomous struggle resistance out for my own interest. I don't fight for somebody else's interest. I fight for my own interest. If I'm a worker, instead of giving to GM that money, I better get my minimum wage better be up. That's my interest. I don't, you know, whatever GM makes, that's their problem. But my interest as a worker is totally different from GM. So if I vote for Obama, I have to have my, I will never vote for him anyway. If I vote for him, I will come with my own position, my own demand on the floor. I have my own interest on the floor. And if you don't do it, then we are in trouble. As a student, the same thing.
I just had a question about kind of the movements that built up before the election, because it seems like the election triggered this kind of mass uprising, specifically more of the women's movements and the students' movements. If you could talk a little bit about that and like how are they organizing now? Are they just, you know, as you're saying, has the opposition just taken them over? Have they lost their focus? Like what were they organizing around, and how did that all kind of build?
There was some women's movement, but women's movement was, they weren't really serious in the realm of politics. They were serious in the realm of social rights, for women specifically. And it never translated into becoming a political issue. So, sure, women were being organized, and I mean minimal, not in great extent. They were organizing themselves, but at the level of what do women want to achieve and get from the Islamic Republic through reform. So, for example, they would ask to have the right to divorce, right? They would ask to have the right to get custody of a child, because in Islam, the child, in case of divorce, goes to the father automatically. They would ask for the right to be able to travel without the permission of the man. You know, basic things that they wanted, which had never become political. In some instances, the state gave those reforms, and in some instances, they resisted the reforms. And it never boiled down to becoming political, so as becoming a threat to the government itself. Most of the achievements, I believe, by women in Iran were achieved individually and not necessarily in an organization or institution, which is the downside of that. And when you try to achieve things on your own, you may be able to get the right to get a divorce from your husband, but that doesn't mean that this helps everybody else or something like that. Now, student movement was more radical and they were more serious. There were many students who were questioning the authority of the state, and they were talking about the overthrow of the state, but a very small number. But they were organized, and I'll tell you this, as soon as they became organized, their leaders were whisked away and put in prison. The few people that I told you about are those that, some were executed, some are still in prison, even before this moment. And the few that I was able to interview in a span of two, three years. Now, all of the people I know and have talked to are all in prison. And they've gotten sentences from anywhere from a year to 10 years. None that I've known have been executed, but you know, now they're in prison. And those were the more serious students.
What about abortion?
I was just wondering about something the media here portrays, like the revolutionary movement in Iran, as if it kept on going, it got fuel because of communication like Twitter mm-hmm. and the internet. And specifically, there was one video that the girl got killed, Neda. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering about like what impact did it have from your point of view?
You're talking about that
like communications and the video, yeah.
I'm a skeptic of technology. Mostly because I think, not because technology is inherently bad, but because it usually feeds into the hands of those who have power. Maybe this instance was the opposite of that. That people use technology to their advantage. And I think in some cases it worked, because as you know, the Islamic, the government there kicked out the reporters, especially those who spoke Persian. Because, you know, if you spoke Persian, you would understand what's going on and get some kind of news. And, but if you spoke English, you would need a translator all the time. And so that may not be available. So I think it helped greatly to show what's going on, especially knowing that there weren't any foreign reporters there and nothing was coming out. But I think that in itself has its limitations, because the government is in control of cell phones and the internet and all of those things, technological, mm-hmm. in Iran. And I'll give you an example. I go to Iran, you get on any kind of, you want to get on a website, political, social, what have you. I'll tell you about, I don't know, I couldn't quantify this, but I could say that about 50% of sites are shut down because state has control over them. It's not like over here or Europe where it's a private entity that has control over it. The government has control over it. So that in itself, if it becomes your only tool to fight, right, is at the same time controlled by the state, because they are the only people in control of electronics. So cell phones are state-sponsored, internet is state-sponsored, everything is state-sponsored. And that is a limitation, if you want to only rely on that. But just that one short period, it was a good thing that people were able to get news out of the country, sure.
And on the video of the girl getting killed?
That was, like I said, that helped out a lot, although it was a sad thing to see, but it helped to sort of gather people around this idea that look at the suppression that's taking place in Iran. And people then began to think about it as something serious and not just something rhetorical. Something that you would just hear. When you see this woman dying in the street, you know, bloody, and you put a face value on rhetoric, on political rhetoric, then you begin to automatically think about it in more serious terms. Sure, it would.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what would you think of, like, a situation in Honduras where you had, like, you know, the fascist coup and you had, like, extreme brutality and repression on anybody who even tries to organize, you know what I'm saying? Like, what kind of predicament are they facing? Because there is no, the alternative can't be made because, you know, they squash any kind, they repress any kind of alternative, so all they're doing is negotiating these little, you know, like, reformist, not even policies with bring us a lie back, which won't do anything anyway,
right.
You know, it'll keep the apparatus intact. So do you see any kind of, like, positive outlook in that situation?
I'm not really familiar with Honduras, just the stuff that I've read and I've seen on mainstream media. I haven't really read into it much, but I think that also has to do with, you know, the fact that there's no political alternative. Given the conditions in Honduras, if there was a serious, not lioness, a serious political alternative, people wouldn't be taking it lightly. The way, you know, you come and you take somebody out, you put in your own government, right? If you have a serious political alternative, that won't happen. But because there's nothing organized in Honduras, like in many countries like Honduras, then sure, the government can come in and do what they want to do and then negotiate over, I guess, minutiae that doesn't really matter, and make it look like we're really negotiating for a viable political alternative. I think because, again, there is repression, there is poverty, there's all kinds of economic crisis, but nothing is happening because there's no political alternative. And there's antagonism, that, you know, classes are clashing, their interests at least, but there is nothing serious happening because there's no political alternative. That is probably, I would say, the fundamental thing to need in order to question the authority of the state, or begin to think about the overthrow of the state. If you don't have political alternative, it's impossible to do it.
I was going to ask, what is your opinion, or what is your, you know, what have you seen in the way of, like, the U.S. Position on this? Because, like, you know, the mass media, they portrayed this as this, like, populist uprising. But, you know, obviously the last thing that the U.S. government really wants is a populist uprising. And then you get like the election in Afghanistan, and they said there was mass fraud there, but there wasn't this like, you know, this outcry by the mainstream media outlets and stuff, or the one in Honduras. And like, is there like, is this like a facetious like, oh yeah, we support them, but really they're, you know, on the side of Ahmadinejad?
Look, I think American foreign policy in the Middle East in general, and specifically in Iran, is driven by more conflict, not less conflict. And let me qualify that. The more antagonism that we perceive, when I say we, I mean America, or even the world, the more antagonism we perceive from the Middle East against the U.S., the better for American foreign policy. And again, let me qualify it by addressing your specific question. I don't know if you remember, but June 12th, June 13th, and 14th and 15th, this is when people came out of the street. About June 16th, 17th, Obama generally said something like, we support the man. And, you know, a very short sentence and left it alone. Republicans were very upset because he didn't say anything else, Obama. And if you remember, they kept on going on TV saying, take a position, we need to take a position and clarify whose side we're on, right? Why was that? Republicans all of a sudden saying, take a position? That doesn't make any sense. They were forcing Obama to take a position because they wanted to make sure that we understand that there's still antagonism and conflict between the Iranian government and the American foreign policy.
So we can funnel more money towards the military.
So we can do all kinds of, I mean, that's a more complicated argument, but partially, right. So we can build more military bases, so we can talk about, well, I don't think invasion is yet a possibility. I'll explain why. And, you know, foreign policy in general. Because, again, American foreign policy in the Middle East is to fail. And I mean to fail to bring peace. Now, American foreign policy at the same time is to create conflict. So the more conflict, the better. So take a position. Tell the world how much we hate you, right? Which will serve our purpose into keeping all of the world on an edge. I mean, this is probably the simplest way I can put it. Keep the world on the edge. And that's why, you know, this idea of taking a position and clarifying that we are against you and you're bad people, you're evil, and so on.
In situations like Iran and other repressive regimes around the world, you speak about a lack of real leadership. If the status quo quells any real opposition, what is the main ingredient in your view that would help build a real alternative in those kind of situations where a real alternative can emerge and the people, or the masses I should say, can rally around that and rally?
That's a really good question. And I want to begin to answer that by saying that one thing I wanted to say in the beginning of my talk was that the difference between opposition during the Shah mm-hmm. and opposition today is qualitatively very much or very big. And let me tell you why. During the Shah, those who worked for the government were paid to work for the government. Today, and I mean not just today, but for the past 30 years for mm-hmm. the Islamic Republic, those who work for the government ideologically believe in the same thing as the government. So you didn't really need to pay them. They believed in the same thing. All right? Now, today, as a result of this mass movement, many of those who ideologically agreed with the Islamic Republic have now questioned it. Right? So that's one ingredient that you need in order to seriously think about a viable alternative. That is, the questioning of the ideology of the state, which before this didn't really happen. People didn't say, down with the Islamic Republic. People didn't say, down with the Supreme Leader. And people didn't say there should be a separation between religion and state. Right, these are three really important things that were achieved during this past 15 months. Right? So those are ingredients that you need. But at the same time, something that is more serious is a real force to be able to overthrow. Therefore, masses gathering around it. Because if you're not able to overthrow and you're merely talking about an overthrow, people won't care anymore. Because, especially in Iran, they've experienced it once. Political alternative said, let's overthrow this guy, the Shah, and we'll build a better society. Mm-hmm. They overthrew it in some manner, but where is the better society? Right? It makes the entire culture, the entire population, very skeptical about, well, wait a minute, maybe you don't want to be so fast, so quick into jumping into overthrow, because how are we going to overthrow and what are we going to do afterwards? So those two things are missing, despite the other three ingredients that I counted that are not missing, that people have achieved. So I think, instrumentally speaking, you need to put forth a program that is able to overthrow a government that's already been questioned by the masses. And people have to reach that state first. Mm-hmm. Did I answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Yes, you did. Thank you.
He's saying the people actually now, I mean, if there will be a revolution in Iran, that revolution will be a theocratic revolution.
It would be?
It won't be.
No, it won't be, right.
It will be more of a democratic revolution.
Yeah, generally, I mean, I don't want to get into the argument of what is democratic. And
no, no,
what,
I'm,
sure,
what I mean
sure.
about that is, for example, like religion. The religion
will be cast aside.
Will cast aside,
right,
where
right.
people will be able to involve and contribute more
correct.
In the political arena.
Correct.
Right. So because the people question.
They've already questioned the authority of
religion. Authority
of religion, and
exactly.
And the religious
government. Exactly.
Right.
So that's what I was
right, right.
Interesting. That's interesting. I think that's good. I think it's very good that type of movement.
Yeah.
That's
why I say it's a giant leap forward.
Yeah, it is. It's very good.
For a country in the Middle East to say
yeah.
we want a secular government.
Yeah, that's actually very good hope.
The same people that brought an Islamic Republic
yeah.
to power.
Yeah,
you know.
That's a good sign. That's a good hope.
It only took one generation. Usually it takes 10 generations.
Few, yeah.
Well, in Europe it took 400 years.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Iran it took
yeah.
30 years. What the
heck?
Yes, sir.
You want to go,
Tom?
Yeah, I have a question. Since you emphasize the necessity of leadership, who do you see being this leadership that these sort of broad movements now need in order to move beyond the point that they've reached? And then, two, what continues to be an obstacle to the development of such? You know, and if for example, the results of an overt leadership is outright repression, killing, torture, and imprisonment. Where does that potentially leave these movements in the future? And what kind of route do we need to think about if that continues to be the case?
You're really pushing me to tell you what I really think.
Let's hear it. Let's hear it.
There is no, like I said, there is no organization that's now able to organize masses. And again, let me tell you what I mean. We have the continuum of left to right, just like any place else in Iran. And in fact, we probably have more than anybody else. If there is, let's say, 50 organizations from left to right in any country, we have 500. So, you know, we're better than anybody else. There's just so many fractions. From the very right to the very left, none of these groups are on the ground in Iran able to organize. That's why I don't think any of them are serious in real terms. Theoretically and ideologically, political talk, sure. They have a whole bunch of things to say. But none of them are there in Iran organizing. And I'm not making this up. You can ask any anybody that knows about.
Can you just go over a little bit about, you know, you're saying how there's a lot of rhetoric between the relationship between Israel and Iran. Can you explain that they're
constantly at it. They're saying death to you and death to you. You're bad. You're nuclear. You're, you know, against Palestine and, you know, all kinds of rhetoric. And I'll tell you, Iran, and when you go, and this has been done, I'm not hypothesizing, they ask people many times, they've asked people in the streets, is Palestine the most important issue for you? 3% said yes. I'm not saying people are not sympathetic to the conflict between Palestine and Israel, but they have so much going on in Iran that they don't understand why is our president out of the blue, all of a sudden, concerned about Palestine. I don't know if you noticed, but Arafat, 6 days after the revolution in Iran, right, end of February of 1979, went to the Islamic Republic, Khomeini specifically, because he was so happy that, look, there is finally a revolutionary government. Now in the Middle East, we can get all the help we want, especially knowing that many Palestinians trained Iranian guerrillas in Palestine and Lebanon. So there was even connection, right? He, with six delegates, went to Iran asking for help. Khomeini told him, go back, we're not giving you anything. In 1979, all of a sudden, 2007, 2008, 2009, the president of Iran says, Palestinian rights in Palestine, this and Palestine that. And Iranians are saying, where did this come from? That has to do with the rhetoric that I'm talking about. Because of Israel. Not because he really believes that he should help Palestinians, because they haven't for 30 years. They haven't. They kicked them out. And they're not serious about it. And at the same time, Israel says, you have nuclear weapon and you're against us, so you're going to kill us, and so we want to kill you, and, you know, all kinds of things. And for the last 30 years, every Friday prayer, I know this for a fact, Iranian masses gather, and I mean Iranian masses organized by the government, death to Israel, death to the U.S., and before it was death to the Soviets, no longer. and yeah, and what happened? Nothing. Mm-hmm. 30, 31 years of death to this and death to that, and we'll kill you, you kill us. In practical terms, there is no real conflict. And I don't know how much simpler I can put it. Can you show me a real conflict? You can't. In fact, the Iran-Contra affair took place through Israel. That is, we gave arms to Iran through Israel. And all of a sudden, we're... Yitzhak Rabin said in 1993, the gateway of peace in the Middle East is through Iran. And here you have this animosity taking place. But
it's sort of invading. You think there's other ways to invade Iran?
Oh, I don't think. Look, for all of the reasons I just gave you, I don't think that American government is in conflict with the Iranian government. In fact, the Iranian government today is exactly what America needs in the region.
Mm-hmm.
Right, a government that's rhetorically against the U.S., but in real terms, helping them all they can.
What about the nuclear?
Sorry, I literally had a question.
No, they're not serious about it. Go read about the nuclear stuff for the past 5 years. It's just today, yes, tomorrow, no, today, yes. It's such foolish thing, and, you know, for them to think that we're so dumb, and we think that, oh yeah, tomorrow maybe there'll be peace, and no, again, it broke off. People don't buy that for a long time. You know, it's been going on. It sounds dumb now. Today, you know, yesterday Iran said, sure, we'll let China and Russia enrich our uranium, then give it to us so we can use it. 2 days ago they said, oh no, we don't think we want to do that. And now, again, the conflict is back and it has its momentum. Now tomorrow you're going to hear the opposite of that, and the next day the opposite of that, and it's going to go on for a long time. And that's why invasion would be detrimental to the U.S., because that's the last thing they want to do. Get rid of a government that really allows them to function the way they want to function in the Middle East. That is putting us on the edge of war is imminent. violence is imminent. Be careful, nuclear weapons, imminent. They're going to attack. This is the way they're trying to make us believe this whole region is. And nothing has happened. Except for occupation.
I just have two questions. The first question is, what do you think, like, what kind of solidarity, like, what can we do? Like, you know, because I personally, when any situation, like, you know, I heard, like, oh, there's some, you know, talk going on, and, like, do you know, like, you know, personally, like, you know, what's going on, like, is my presence will actually mean something? So that's the first question, like, what kind of solidarity, you know, do you think will be beneficial to what's happened? And the second question is, like, you know, for an organization that is trying to, you know, create an alternative here, what kind of lessons do you think, you know, we can learn from what's happening right now in Manila?
Look, the Vietnam War ended to the Vietnamese advantage, that is, I think they won, because of two main factors. Number one, the Viet Cong fighting against U.S. forces, and of course the French initially, and Americans protesting here. What I mean by saying that is, the only thing that we should be able to do, or groups like yours or ours, is to expose the real politics that's taking place. And that's basically it. Because through the mainstream media, we get this distorted view of the Middle East. And I think more conscious people who are able to analyze and think critically about what's going on, it's their duty to expose those politics. It may be a general answer, but one of the ways that Americans found out about the dictatorial settings of the Shah, that is how he was repressing, was because of the activity of the Iranian movement, Iranian students here. And if they had not exposed the Shah to be a dictator, Americans here wouldn't know that he was a dictator and he's repressing the people over there. So I think exposing what's going on, both in terms of what the American government's trying to achieve and what the Iranian government's trying to achieve, to show that the Iranian government's saying, look, there's a lot of support by the masses for us and everything is cool, there's not a whole lot of opposition, and then the American government saying that the Iranian government is a bad government, you know, the stuff that's taking place that's in the mainstream, we need to expose that to not be true. I think that's one of the better things that we can do. Other than that, no, we can't send arms over there.
In addition to what Abdi said, I think one of the best forms to support those struggles is for us to organize in the belly of the beast. You mentioned in the 60s, in the Vietnam War, there was a student movement in the United States, a student movement that was pretty advanced, that was actually fighting and denouncing imperialism. And I think if we think we're just going to give solidarity to those people, like humanitarian help, we're dreaming, because some other reaction and fuck is going to take over anyway. The best help is to organize in the belly of the beast. We have in the United States the most advanced capitalist country in the world. There is no mass movement. There is no organization. There's different little groups. Most of them are issue-oriented, not social-oriented, but having a vision as student. By the way, I think in LA there are some student organizing that is being done, but it's still pretty limited. In FIU, there need to be a student movement. In Miami-Dade, there need to be a student movement. In different places, students that are politically conscious need to start organizing, because that's the best way we could give solidarity to somebody else who is in struggle in their own country. We cannot go fight their fight for them, but at least we could denounce in the belly of the beast their reactionary practice. And the same thing, I think I have in the 70s when the Shah in the United States, in New York, I was engaged with a lot of Iranian students. We were having our struggle. Myself, we are in different views. We have different views. I was from Haiti. We were thinking of the working class. They were thinking of a student movement, and we had a very big differences. But at least we were together in the street and fighting. In fact, when I think they arrested a bunch of Iranian students, immigration arrested a bunch of Iranian students in New York, they refused to give their name. And because by law in the United States, you can't be in jail for a long time. We went to the Haitian community among Haitians that didn't carry any paper. We told them, this is the same thing to do. When you get arrested, don't give your name. Don't speak, don't talk. Because they don't know if you're black, but they don't know if you're Haitian. They don't know if you're African American, so they can't hold you.
Iranian.
And that was so, they have to keep them at least for 24 hours and let them go, because all of them refused to speak, which was a form of struggle that was pretty connected to their struggle, which Iranian brought to the struggle in the United States. So I think one of the first steps, addition to what Abdi said, everybody call me professor. But I'm not going to go down.
Yeah, that's what I pretend.
Lucky for me, I didn't go in your classes. Is to organize here and build student organization and start building a real democratic student movement, which is capable of not only organizing one your shit here, because if you can't fight your shit, how are you going to support some other struggle? And, you know, there is budget cut, different thing that the economy is affecting students. So we need to organize here, and through that struggle, our political conscience will raise enough to understand what's going on in Iran, what's going on in Haiti, what's going on in different parts of the world, in Honduras, and participate in that struggle too.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you very much. I have a short comment and a question that stems from the comment. In the 50s and leading into the 60s in Latin America, let's call it a Christian life.
Uh-huh.
Okay. That started to explore the relationships in theological, political, social ways between Marxism and the new
Christianity.
Right? And specifically as the mid 60s, way into the late 70s. Really, really strongly in El Salvador, Nicaragua.
Mm-hmm.
There was a great participation of declared Catholics, Christians within the armed movement.
Right.
Okay. And as a matter of fact, there's what we call martyrdom, but it's after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
It's not go get yourself killed in the struggle because you're gonna something is some hopeful situation. No, it's after the fact. It's like kind of remembering people.
Right.
Interesting difference. Cultural difference within a theological conception. Having said that, my question is: there within modern Islam, if that even exists, right? And that people, if I can say that you know of anybody or any groups exploring relationships that don't separate Marxist thought and Islam or Muslim, but are more trying to look at relationships that can be politicized and that lead to armed struggle?
Sure. It goes back to the first organization that did that was organized, established in 1970 in Iran, 69-70, which was the People's Mujahideen. And in fact, the way they infused Marxism and Islam was so nicely done that by 1975, an entire faction of Marxists came out of it. You understand? So they said, forget Islam, we're Marxists. However, and there was great conflict between the two. But it started in 1970, but to this day, we even have more groups that have infused the two ideas. And also don't feel that there's a contradiction. They feel that there are parts of Islam that talks about liberation and fighting against oppression. And certainly there are parts of Marxism that do the same thing. And so we can put this together and have one idea
the utopian communist classless society, right, that Marx writes about. The Islamic leftists, the ones that I'm talking about, called it, let me translate this, the moral classless society, you know, putting that morality, that religion thing in it, which was basically the same concept. And in fact, almost everything they wrote about used both ideas. And so it goes back to the 1970s, and it continues. We have more groups that do the infusion, or the coalescing of the two ideas. Although to many people it's contradictory, like you said, these groups, they make sense going together. Did I answer your question?
No, just one last, a little last piece. So is any of that type of thinking, searching, actually, is there any possibility, what you know, that would lead to armed struggle?
Theoretically, almost all of them believe in that. But
theoretically?
Yeah, but like I said, there is. Let me tell you this. When the Islamic Republic established itself in Iran by early 1980, because it came to power in 1979, called itself the temporary Islamic Republic. After 3-4 years, when it got done repressing all of the opposition, right, and it felt stronger and established, they began to go to Kurdistan, which was the only region in Iran that was armed. You know, the few groups were armed. Now, all of the opposition, therefore, went to Kurdistan, because that was the only area where they could fight, right? And this is the irony of history. During the war with Iraq, Saddam gave information to the Iranian government about where these opposition groups are. And then the Iranian government went and bombarded all of their camps and killed probably 90% of them. The 10% that survived went to Europe, mostly. They're in France, England, Sweden, Germany, you know, all the countries in Europe. And so therefore, all of them are there now, but still talking about armed struggle. You know, different versions of armed struggle, but still talking about it. So therefore, there's actually nobody there in Iran from any of these groups that's remotely serious about armed struggle.
Thank you. I was just wondering, I remember you did a conference on suicide bombers, and I was just wondering now, in present day Iran, has there been a lot of suicide bombers or what?
No, this is an interesting question. I had a conversation with a friend of mine in Iran, and he said, because we were talking about suicide bombing, and he said, it's really funny, why don't we have suicide bombers in Iran?
They got smart.
They got what?
They got smart.
Smart? No, that's not the answer.
Oh, shit.
The answer is suicide bombers are in power. That is, those who believe in suicide bombing have the state.
Mm. That's smart.
Right? So, so it doesn't, and I'm being very general with this, because that's not the definition of suicide bomber, but as far as the Iranian government is concerned, and the belief in suicide bombing, if you have power, you don't become a suicide bomber, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the basic idea behind suicide bombing is powerlessness. The more powerless you feel, and I don't mean powerless psychologically, I mean militarily, the more powerless you feel, the higher the chance of you conducting struggle like that, or whatever it is that you think is a fight.
Mm-hmm.
But because these people are in power, there is no suicide bombing in Iran. In fact, you never hear about any Iranian suicide bombing.
I was just wondering about that, because in the media they showed a couple of suicide bombers, but it was in other countries, like there was in Pakistan, in...
Yeah, in Iraq, Pakistan, Chechnya, Sri Lanka.
And even Afghanistan.
Lebanon, Palestine.
But
in
there
Somalia
was,
now.
Yeah, but they didn't mention anything about Iran, so I was just wondering about that.
Yeah, but let me also say this. Suicide bombing is not entirely correlated with religion. We have many secular suicide bombers. In fact, the Sri Lankan Tamil Tigers are Marxists. And modern men's suicide bombing started with them in 1980, way before
you know, there was suicide bombings of the way you see it by those who were religious. You know, Spanish Civil War, there was suicide bombings. Kamikazes, that's not a really religious idea. There was sort of suicide bombings. So you don't have to be religious, whether Islamic, Christian, Jew, to be a suicide bomber. It has to do with the fundamental reason behind suicide bombing is invasion of the foreigner. That is, if you have foreign forces in your land, the chances of suicide bombing become really, really high. Which has nothing to do with your religiosity. It has to do with how powerless you feel in fighting against this really huge military force, and how you do. Look, if suicide bombing organizations, they usually go anywhere from 100 to 200-300 people, right?
Mm-hmm.
If instead of 300 people they had 30,000 people, they would never do suicide bombing, because that gives them power to fight. But if you're small and feel really powerless, then the chances of becoming suicide bomber increases, because it's the only thing that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
For them. That's for us.
I just want to expand to what you say about organizing. I think sometimes we say things, sometimes misinterpret. I think personally, to me, as far as looking at the world economic condition, one of the biggest things I think young people should be doing is studying. Is studying so they can think with their own brain. That's the key, and I think Malcolm X, I think, say that at the end of his life, when he realized, when he grew out of the Nation of Islam, he started to develop his own political thinking. And he learned that to think with his own brain was really the best thing we can do to contribute to the struggle. I think what young people, all of us, have to really do is to read and study. Read and study about some of the best minds in the history of social struggle. You can go back all the way back, for example, I'm reading a great book, actually, which is very, very good. I would recommend every one of you guys to read it. It's called the History of the American, by Howard Zinn, I think it's called The American
U.S.
People's
History.
Yes, People's of the U.S.
It's a popular program.
I think it's a very interesting book to understand the history of the U.S. from the people's view, from the people's perspective, from the bottom perspective. And the people who contribute in the struggle, they were bright, intelligent people that really, sometimes in politics, it's a game of chess. You make the wrong move, you can lose your life. Simple as that. So we learn from the past, learn from them, so we can become better. So we become better in the way we think, in the way we organize, in the way we strategize, so we can confront the challenge that we face. As I was saying earlier to my young man right here, what's your name again?
Adam.
Adam. I said to Adam is,
and that's
I told Adam, I told Adam, our generation face the greatest challenge in the history of mankind. I strongly believe that. We face our generation will dictate if there is life in the next 100 of years on this planet, or if there is going to be no life. We face an environmental crisis where a country like Maldives trying to get the world attention by doing press conferences underwater, where water going to take over this land, where they're going to have to move those people to another land. Socially, the economic, the condition that we face do not have solution to this problem. And I think our personal intellectual and social contribution is necessary. We have to read and study and think and develop a sound plan of action to confront those challenges. That's my personal feedback.
Thomas and then Danny?
I agree that studying and thinking and learning about past struggles is very important. But it's kind of like sharpening the axe. If we're not going to use it, what's the point of sharpening the axe?
You're going to be forced to use it.
But my point is, yeah, absolutely. Study, find out about past struggles, find out what we can learn from them. But also, we just don't want to learn about history. We want to make history. And the way we're going to make history is learning these lessons, but getting involved, getting organized with others, whether it's in our communities, in our workplaces, in our schools, wherever it is, you know, getting organized and trying to create history based partially on the lessons from history, but also based on our own conditions that we face uniquely, because, you know, things aren't exactly the same as they were in the past. But yeah, so I would just say that piece.
Because knowledge is not power, practicing knowledge.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. You're going to be forced to be organized. The condition that we have will force the people to respond, which means like there's a cause and effect. The state will suppress, and the people will, you know, there's interaction, which means you're going to be forced to be organized. And the question, once you're organized, you want to make sure you're organized in a way that, because the bourgeoisie, or the ruling class in the United States, is working non-stop to protect its interests, tirelessly, which means they're watching you, they're watching your movement, non-stop. So now when you're organizing, you better organize in a way that they're going to get hit, but they don't know where that hit is going to come from. You know what I mean? We're going to force to do it. And I said, we have no choice. We're going to dictate our action, what we do in our generation, I believe, will dictate whether we survive as the human race or we perish.
Daniel's comment. Considering the time, maybe we'll have one more comment after Daniel, and maybe we can just start wrapping it up after then if no one else has any like burning questions or comments.
Right. To respond to what you just said, I think the nature of organization is to study, which is a collective work. You mentioned Malcolm X. Malcolm X was not alone. Everybody talk about Malcolm X. Malcolm X was part of an organization. He joined the Muslim first. When he found out there were no solution the Muslim could offer to the society, he formed his own political organization, which was partly, I think it was a socialist party or something. If an organization cannot organize for its member to study collectively and learn how to transform that reality, this is what knowledge and theory is all about. Because if you have a theory and you can't use that theory, it's a dead theory. It's no use to anyone. A theory should be a guide for transformation. It should be something that you study. I'm an organized member. I didn't go to school. I learned my knowledge through organizing. Because for me, I believe the more you get knowledge, the more democratic the organization becomes. The more knowledge is popularized, the more people participate into that organization, into that structure. Now, there is two levels of organization. There is a revolutionary organization that really work for political change, and there's a mass organization where anybody could be part of it. Student, if you have a student, anybody could be a Muslim, it could be a Catholic, voodoo, anybody could come to that organization and participate. And you identify your problem, you collectively study it, you understand it, because if you don't understand it, you can't change it. That's all the level of an organization. That's the power of an organization. There is no individual solution. The solution will always be collective. So, and that's what the nature of the force of an organization.
You want to make comment or you
read? Oh, I mean, books is just, it's great to, you know, be able to have all these books to read, but books is also a form of technology. I don't think we can just rely on books. I think, you know, when we just sit and read, you know, we're separating ourselves from the community.
No, I think I disagree with that.
But I think, you know, I think what we need to do more is join in the community, you know, ask about others' experiences, you know, in the movement. And that's not disregard, you know, books in itself, but, you know, we got to also use, communication, you know, go up to the person that's standing next to you, ask them their experiences, and then I think that's a really good way to learn as well, because if you look at some of these cultures, there are some cultures that don't, you know, that didn't rely on, you know, the written word, they relied on communication, and that's how, you know, that's how people learn and survive.
The reason I wanted to respond, I'm not saying books is the sole answer to really find a solution. What I said was, for my own personal study, a check it out. Is a giant, you have a giant intellect. Fidel Castro is a giant intellect. These are exceptional human beings that really, in a way, contribute greatly. But what study does, it sharpens the intellect.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you see better. So you're not even become naive and passionate about the idea of justice,
mm-hmm.
where you don't see the obstacles coming. You know what I mean? So those experiences and those and the books will help you to be able to see the obstacle, to judge, give you better judgment, so you can act better. You know what I mean? Because the passion, the passion for justice and the passion to change the world is, you know, you have it, but the books will sharpen you, I think. That's why I say it's important for us to do that. We'll sharpen you and make you become better actors.
I certainly don't mean to drag the conversation on, because I would like for it to end. But,
don't hold back now.
I never do. But I think if you were to ask someone like Castro where he learned his greatest lessons, it would be through his experiences. I think he said that before. And that's all I have to say about that. And please don't respond.
No, then listen to the shit. If you don't want me to respond, you just give me something and probably accept it.
He just wants you to think
about it. No, but if you listen to Che also, when he's speaking to young people, and I have it quoted, he said, one thing I would like to say to young people is to study. Study so you can understand the world yourself. And when you understand it, you will act, you will make mistakes, and you will learn from your mistakes, you will continue to act, make more mistakes, and you know what I mean? Until you get what you want.
Daniel, and then we'll wrap it up.
And I'm actually applying another style. I think studying need to be checked. Studying need to be put into tests in the street. This is how we're going to find out if they are correct or not. This is how we're going to find out if we need to have another solution. I think if we learn a story of the world, of the universe, of humankind, it is how people advance. Through check and balance, you have a theory, you go out there, you check it, you learn from it, and you come with a new theory. I'm a member of MAS. If anybody, MAS is an organization that is actually hoping to build an alternative, political alternative in Miami. If anybody wants to get more interested, they could put their name on the table. We are open for discussion. We need to build organization. This is why this wasn't for credit. This meeting here is basically for us to discuss and learn and see how best we could organize ourselves and advance in the organizing process in the struggle. And also, we are open to discuss in any form of organization, as long as it is an organization of struggle in any situation. If you work in a factory, we will be there. We're working with taxi drivers. We're working with different people in order to organize them. I will keep you informed sometime on the struggle of the taxi drivers. They will be doing some action in a couple of weeks. And anybody who is interested or something that they need to be struggling in a collective orientation, we are open to participate in their struggle.
And with that, I want to give Mr. Abdi a round of applause for for everybody who showed up, because I think it says something to come out to an event like this about yourselves. And you know, as Daniel stated, you know, the organizations put this together, one's a student organization, the other one being the group MAS. We have a contact list. We hope to be having more events of this sort in the future, and we hope that the faces that are here tonight will multiply and we'll be able to have deeper, more intense discussions. Thank you, Professor Abdi, for your candid views on the subject. And we hope to be able to, you know, have you again sometime.
Thank you.
Yeah. You don't need to sign up for the honors.